It is my distinct pleasure to introduce this evening's speaker, Faye Dowker. Faye is a professor of theoretical physics at Imperial College in London in the UK. Under the supervision of Professor Stephen Hawking, she received her PhD from the University of Cambridge in 1990. She has done postdoctoral work at Fermilab, at the University of California at Berkeley, University of California at Santa Barbara, and at Caltech. Her research interests are in quantum gravity, especially causal set theory, and in the foundations of quantum mechanics. I have had the distinct pleasure of getting to know Faye over the last couple years, and I assure you we are in for a treat. Ladies and gentlemen, to tell us why black holes are hot, here is Faye Dowker.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction, and good evening, everyone. The particle physicist Richard Feynman declared that if humanity were to suffer a catastrophe in which all of scientific knowledge were lost, and he was able to choose one and only one fact, one science fact, to convey to the survivors to help them rebuild science from scratch, that he would choose to tell them all things are made of atoms. So it's hard to disagree with that choice. It is indeed a marvelous discovery, something that underpins our modern scientific understanding of matter. But it's interesting to reflect that not much more than 100 years ago, that the existence of atoms and molecules was actually controversial amongst physicists. There wasn't any consensus that atoms and molecules really existed. Consensus was reached in 1905, and the final evidence was provided by Einstein in a paper that he wrote in that remarkable year, one of five he wrote in that remarkable year, on Brownian motion. And I will return to Brownian motion at the end of my talk. I believe that 100 years later, we stand at a similar juncture in the history of science. But today, instead of the question about the structure of matter, the question is, is space-time itself continuous, or is it granular and discrete? Tonight, I'm going to trace a thread through science which leads us to a proposal for an answer to this question. The dichotomy between continuity of existing things on the one hand and granularity or atomicity on the other is something which has been part of human exploration of the nature of our world since ancient times. But I'm not going to go all the way back through ancient history tonight. We're going to start our story a mere 150 years ago with the science of thermodynamics. Thermodynamics is the science of heat, of thermal systems. The concepts with which it deals, such as temperature, pressure, heat, energy, cycles, and above all, mechanical work, pushing, pulling, and turning things, they're all crucial to the understanding of a big steam engine. And here's a nice example of one. It's in the Science Museum in London. It's very magnificent and beautiful. And the coincidence between the rise of industrial production and the development of thermodynamics is no surprise at all. So thermodynamics deals with systems which are hot, thermal systems, and the developments, the understanding that people gained about thermal systems were codified into a series of laws, the laws of thermodynamics. And here are the two most important laws. The first law says that the change in energy of a system equals the amount of heat that you add to that system minus the work done on the system. So if you add heat to a system, its energy increases. So you can think of the system as a big, say, think of it as a big steam engine. But as that engine does work, as it pushes, pulls, and turns things, then it loses energy. So you add heat, it gains energy. The engine does work, it loses energy. So that's the first law. The second law of thermodynamics says that the entropy of an isolated system, that's a system which is not interacting with its environment, with anything around it, never decreases. Now, we're going to dig into these laws a little bit. And to understand them, we have to ask the question, two questions. What is heat? And what is entropy? So what is heat? One theory for what heat is was around in the 19th century. The idea was that heat was something, a new kind of substance, something that flowed in and out of an object as you heat it up and cool it down, some kind of new fluid. But now we understand heat as a property of the atoms and molecules that make up matter. So heat is the energy of disordered motion of the atoms and molecules that make up matter. So here's my cup of coffee. It's hot. The coffee is not moving anywhere. It's not sloshing around in the cup or anything. So it doesn't look like the coffee is moving. But its internal microscopic constituents, the molecules that make up the coffee, are moving. They're moving in a disordered way. They're jiggling around, bumping into each other, and they have energy because they're moving. And that energy is exactly heat energy. So this understanding, this proposal for what heat is, was a unifying proposal. It unified heat with something that was very familiar, just energy due to motion. You don't need any extra special kind of new substance to understand what heat is. This atomic structure of matter unified this phenomenon of heat with mechanical energy due to motion that was already understood. And the first law is then unified with a law that people were already very familiar with, which is the law of conservation of energy. Energy cannot be created or destroyed. The first law merely expresses that fact. It says that the change in energy of the system is equal to the heat that you add, and that heat is just the mechanical energy due to the jiggling motion of the molecules and atoms that make up the system, minus the work done. So what is entropy? Well, here, Ludwig Boltzmann, who is one of the pictures that you saw flashing on the screen before the lecture, made the proposal that tells us how to understand entropy. Boltzmann said that entropy is a measure of how many ways the atoms in some system can be configured so that you can't tell the difference macroscopically. So if you think about my cup of coffee, it's hot, the atoms and molecules are jiggling around, and it's very high entropy because it's hot. And it's high entropy because there are many ways that those molecules can be moving. They can be moving in all sorts of different ways, and we wouldn't be able to tell at the macroscopic level. So it's high entropy because there are many different ways that the atoms and molecules can be moving around microscopically. Now, this understanding of what entropy is makes the second law quite comprehensible. In fact, it makes it analogous to situations in everyday life that are extremely familiar. So the example of the teenager's bedroom is often cited. So a teenager's bedroom can be in two states, pretty much. It's either tidy, which is a low entropy state, or it's messy, which is a high entropy state. So the tidy bedroom is a low entropy state because there are very few ways that you can arrange the objects in the bedroom so that the bedroom is tidy. Pretty much everything has its place, and only when everything is in its place is the bedroom tidy. So this is low entropy. It's very ordered. The situation when the bedroom is messy is quite different. There are many different configurations of the objects that they can have so that the bedroom is messy. A messy bedroom is a high entropy state. And everybody knows that the transition between a tidy bedroom and a messy bedroom is the typical thing. If you don't do anything, if you make no effort whatsoever, typically the tidy bedroom will eventually become messy. It'll reach a state of maximum mess in a very short time. So entropy typically tends to increase. The opposite direction is when the tidy bedroom becomes the messy bedroom becomes tidy, and everybody knows that that's not possible without a lot of external effort. So if the bedroom is isolated and no effort is made whatsoever, then there's no way that this messy bedroom is going to evolve spontaneously into a tidy bedroom. You need a lot of external effort and energy put into the system to transform the mess, the high entropy state into the low entropy state. So the second law of thermodynamics is the statement that disorder tends to increase. The entropy of a box of gas depends on many things, many properties of the box of gas. The hotter the gas in the box, the higher the entropy, because when you add heat to a box of gas, the heat energy that you add can be distributed amongst the particles of the gas in many different ways. There are many different configurations that the molecules can be in, many different ways that they can be moving. So as you increase the temperature, the entropy goes up. If you give the gas more room to be in, then there are many more configurations that the atoms and molecules can have. And so again, the entropy will rise. But the most important factor that governs the entropy of a hot gas in a box is actually the number of molecules. And the entropy is actually proportional to the number of molecules. So if you double the number of molecules in your box of gas, you double the entropy. And that's a nice way to understand how life on Earth can be compatible, not in contradiction with the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics says that disorder tends to increase. And you might think that the growth of a tree, for example, contradicts that, because a tree is a very ordered state of all the atoms that make it up. It's much more ordered than the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the water in the soil that have been synthesized to make this tree. So it seems like order has increased, or in other words, that the second law has been violated. But of course, a tree is not an isolated system. Remember, the second law only works when the system is isolated and there's no external intervention. A tree is not isolated, it's receiving light energy, it's receiving energy from the sun. And you can think of life on Earth as a whole in this way. So the Earth is not an isolated system. It receives energy from the sun in the form of electromagnetic radiation. The order of the constituents of the Earth and things on the Earth can increase. So trees can grow and the order can increase. However, the Earth is not a closed system. We have to include the electromagnetic radiation which interacts with the Earth as well. Now, by conservation of energy, the Earth receives energy from the sun, which is absorbed, but it also gives out energy. The Earth is radiating. It's not radiating invisible light. The Earth doesn't glow. We can't see it. It doesn't shine. However, it is radiating in the infrared. So it's giving off infrared radiation, receiving electromagnetic radiation, which is light in the form of light. So you can think of the light that the Earth is receiving in terms of the photons of the particles of light that it's receiving. Each photon of light of a particular color has the same energy. So the spectrum of light that the Earth receives from the sun is pretty much the largest fraction of the radiation is in the color yellow. So most of the photons that arrive at the Earth's surface are yellow photons, and they all have the same energy. And the infrared photons that are given off, they also have exactly the same energy as each other. But the energy of a photon of infrared radiation is about 20 times less than the energy of a yellow light photon that hits the Earth. Because of conservation of energy, 20 times more infrared photons have to be radiated to be the same amount of energy that the Earth receives from the sun. So the Earth receives a certain number of yellow photons, and it gives off 20 times that number of infrared photons. And because entropy is proportional to the number, roughly speaking, the entropy of the radiation increases 20 times from being absorbed to being radiated. So there's a huge entropy increase of the radiation. And that means that if you add the radiation with the constituents of the Earth, altogether that's the entropy of that system increases. So life on Earth is perfectly compatible with the second law of thermodynamics. Okay, so before we leave thermodynamics, I'm going to give you the laws again. But I've stated the first law as an equation, and I've done that deliberately, because you'll see why later on. We're going to see something rather dramatic. So I've just stated in symbols what we had in words before. This Greek letter delta means change in, and E is energy. So this is just change in energy is equal to, and this is heat. It looks a little unfamiliar. Delta, again, is change, and S is entropy. So this is change in entropy times T, which is temperature. That's actually heat. It's a little hard to explain why that's heat, but you can understand why it has something that adding heat has something to do with increasing entropy, because, as I said before, when you add heat to a system, the atoms and molecules jiggle around more, and there's more ways to distribute the energy amongst those microscopic constituents. So when you add heat, you increase the entropy. So that's why there's this increase of entropy term here. This is heat, and then minus the work that the system does, as before. W is work. And I'll just remind you again that S is the entropy. The entropy of a system never decreases so long as that system is isolated. Now, nothing could seem more different from the physics of the boiler room, the physics of steam engines, than the physics of gravity. Our best theory of gravity is general relativity. And GR, for short, unifies gravity and space-time. It tells us that the phenomenon, gravitational phenomena, are nothing more than the manifestation of the curvature of a fabric called space-time. This fabric of space-time is both the arena for everything that happens and also an actor in reality. Space-time has its own plot, it has its own lines, it has its own dynamics and its own laws of motion. It's an active participant in reality. It's a fabric that bends, warps, ripples, and carries energy. So space-time is indeed a thing. General relativity tells us that compact objects, such as stars, can and will undergo gravitational collapse to form black holes. Black holes are the epitome of general relativity because they are pure space-time. They're regions of space-time from which nothing, not even light, can escape. And they're characterized by an event horizon, which is a surface in space-time, which divides the region from which nothing can escape, the interior of the black hole, from the rest of the universe. Black holes are the simplest, most elegant macroscopic objects in the universe. Now, in the 1960s and 70s, we didn't have any black holes to play with in the lab. We still don't have black holes to play with in the lab. But gravitational physicists, or relativists, experimented on black holes nevertheless, but they experimented on black holes using pencil and paper and using the mathematics of general relativity, including this equation, which is Einstein's equation, for how space-time curves and warps. This side of the equation describes the curvature, the warpage of space-time, how that curvature is fixed, is designated, is governed by the distribution of matter. The matter is
is described by this side of the equation. This is some, I think it's in some amazing train in Bolivia. And I, although it says Albert Einstein here, I doubt that he actually wrote this on there. But it's quite, you'll see as we go on that it's somehow quite spooky that this Einstein equation is written on, indeed, a steam engine. What these relativists discovered, using their pencils and paper, was that black holes are very simple. They have only three properties, three characteristics: mass, charge, and angular momentum. That's how fast they're spinning. There's no other property of a black hole that can be seen from the outside of from the exterior of the black hole. People coined the slogan, "Black holes have no hair." They just have these three properties, and that's it. They have no other characteristics. And these black holes satisfy a series of laws. And I feel now that I should have some kind of drum roll or something to give you the feeling that you're going to see something rather amazing. So in 1973, Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking wrote a paper called The Laws of Black Hole Mechanics. And that was a deliberate choice of title. They wanted it to mirror the laws of thermodynamics, because there was indeed a remarkable analogy between the laws that they discovered that govern black holes and the laws of thermodynamics. So the first law of black hole mechanics is the following. It says that delta, remember delta means change in, the change in the mass, m, is equal to, forget this numerical factor for a minute, kappa. Kappa stands for the surface gravity of a black hole. It's the strength of the, it's the acceleration due to gravity at the horizon of the black hole as measured by someone who's far away. So that's the surface gravity, times delta, the change in A, which is the area, the surface area of the horizon. So the change in the mass is the surface gravity times the change in the area, minus the work, mechanical work, that the black hole does. Now you might say, how does a black hole do mechanical work? Well, for example, a black hole might have a charge. Let's say it has negative charge. And let's say you lower a positively charged object towards the black hole and into the black hole. Positive and negative charges attract each other, so the black hole is pulling on the positively charged object as the positively charged object is lowered towards it. So it's pulling on this positively charged object. It's doing work. It's doing mechanical work on that object. And that mechanical work is exactly the sort of term that appears in here. Okay. The second law of black hole mechanics, also known as Hawking's area theorem, is that the surface area of the black hole horizon, A, never decreases. Okay. Now, you've seen something quite like this before, not many minutes ago. Let me show you the laws of thermodynamics just underneath the laws of black hole mechanics. You can see that the two first laws and the two second laws have exactly the same form. Where there's mass here, there's energy here. Where there's surface gravity here, there's temperature here. Where there's area of event horizon here, there's entropy here. And again, area and entropy play the same role in the second laws as each other. Now, in one respect, so the way that Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking described the situation is that they said, this is an analogy. An analogy is that there's a structural similarity, but these are not the same things. But in one way, they are the same thing. Well, two ways, actually. These terms are really mechanical work. This is really mechanical work that the black hole does. This is really mechanical work that the thermal system does. But in another way, it's more than an analogy. We know from relativity that mass and energy are the same thing. They're just different manifestations of the same concept. E equals mc squared, mass and energy are equivalent. When an object moves faster and gains energy because it's moving faster, its mass increases. So mass and energy really are the same thing. This is more than an analogy. Physically, this is the same thing as this. However, this term is very mysterious. How could area and entropy be the same thing? They're just completely different, seemingly, completely different concepts. So this analogy between horizon, area, and entropy, is it more? Could it be more than an analogy? The physicist Jacob Bekenstein said, yes. Not just yes, it is, but yes, it must be. It must be the case that a black hole has a physical entropy, and that physical entropy is its horizon area. And he argued that it must be, because otherwise the second law can be violated. And he argued in the following way. Suppose we have a black hole, and it doesn't have any entropy. And we have some system which has entropy outside the black hole, a box of gas, say. We can decrease the entropy of the stuff outside the black hole by taking that box of entropy and throwing it into the black hole. The entropy outside's decreased. You got rid of it all. You hid it inside the black hole horizon. And so you violated the second law of thermodynamics. And violating the second law of thermodynamics is a bad thing. And I'm going to quote to you, read you a quotation from a lecture, a public lecture by Arthur Eddington, the astrophysicist. I thoroughly recommend these public lectures by Eddington. They're incredibly entertaining, and you can get them, you can read them online. So Eddington said, the law that entropy always increases, the second law of thermodynamics, holds the supreme position among the laws of nature. If someone points out to you that your pet theory of the universe is in disagreement with Maxwell's equations, then so much the worse for Maxwell's equations. If it is found to be contradicted by observation, well, these experimentalists do bungle things sometimes. But if your theory is found to be against the second law of thermodynamics, I can give you no hope. There is nothing for it but to collapse in deepest humiliation. So to save the second law, Bekenstein proposed the following. He proposed that black holes themselves must have entropy, and that entropy is proportional to the area of the event horizon. And he proposed the following generalized second law, which is that the entropy outside the black hole plus the entropy of the black hole, meaning that's the entropy of the total system, entropy of stuff outside black hole plus entropy of black hole, never decreases. And this means that you can't violate the second law by throwing stuff into a black hole and decreasing the entropy outside, because if you do, you throw the stuff in the black hole, the black hole increases in mass, it gets bigger, its horizon area increases, and that increase in horizon area, in other words, increase in black hole entropy, compensates, more than compensates, for the decrease in entropy of the stuff outside. Now, famously, Hawking thought that Bekenstein was wrong. And the reason he thought that Bekenstein was wrong was that for anything to have entropy, it must have a temperature. And if something has a temperature, then it radiates, it must radiate. And everybody knew, that black holes don't radiate, they don't emit anything. They can only absorb stuff. Once stuff falls into the black hole, nothing can come out. So a black hole is cold, it doesn't have any temperature. And Hawking set out to prove Bekenstein wrong, and the drama and irony of what happened next is not lost on anybody. He actually made the discovery that ties everything all together and proves that Bekenstein was right. Black holes do have an entropy. So what Stephen Hawking discovered are that black holes are hot. They have a temperature, they do radiate, and the reason that black holes are hot is quantum theory and the structure of the quantum vacuum. So empty space in a quantum theory is a very busy place. It's full of seething activity. And you can think of that activity as pair production and annihilation of particles, such as pairs of photons. They appear spontaneously out of the vacuum, they last for a little while, and then they annihilate with each other again and disappear. And under normal circumstances, we don't notice any of that seething quantum fluctuations of the vacuum. But when there's a black hole present, then it has a dramatic effect. When this is some artist's impression of the black hole horizon, these are pairs, particle pairs, which appear out of the vacuum and then disappear again. But if a pair of particles is produced close outside the black hole horizon, but close to the horizon, one of the pairs of particles can fall into the black hole and therefore never be able to come out again. And the other one of the pair can escape off to far away from the black hole, carrying energy with it. And because energy is therefore being lost from the system, and the only thing in the system is the black hole, it's the black hole itself which is losing mass. It's losing losing energy, which is equivalent to mass. It's losing mass and getting smaller. Hawking calculated the temperature of the black hole and showed that it's equal to its surface gravity up to this constant 1 over 2 pi. So this is known as the Hawking temperature. And then to be consistent with the first law of black hole mechanics, the black hole must have an entropy. And the entropy is indeed, as Bekenstein said, proportional to its horizon area, and it's proportional with a factor of a quarter. Now you may ask, in what units am I talking about the area of the horizon? Am I talking about centimeters squared? What is this area measured in? And I'll answer that question a little later. Okay, so here are the laws again. This discovery that black holes are hot and that black holes have a temperature and their temperature is the surface gravity means that the first law of black hole mechanics is the first law of thermodynamics. They are one and the same thing. They're unified together into the first law of black hole thermodynamics. They're the same thing. Mass is energy. Surface gravity is temperature. Area is entropy. It's the same law. And the Hawking area theorem, that the area never decreases, is the second law of thermodynamics. So this unification brings together thermodynamics, gravitational physics, and quantum theory. And contemplating this, one has the feeling of standing at the very threshold of unity. And yet it's only the threshold. We haven't passed beyond into full unity because gravity and quantum theory in black hole thermodynamics are not fully unified. The gravitational physics that goes into the laws of black hole thermodynamics is classical general relativity. The quantum theory that goes into the laws of black hole thermodynamics is quantum theory of matter in a black hole background. It's not quantum theory of gravity. It's not a quantum theory of gravity. It's not a theory in which gravitational phenomena and quantum phenomena are fully unified into a coherent picture. So standing on the threshold of unity it's incredibly moving and tempting to ask, well, what lies beyond that threshold? And I believe that the laws of black hole thermodynamics give us the clue to what is missing in trying to unify gravity with quantum theory. So I believe that we stand at the same juncture as people who are studying thermodynamics without having an atomic picture of nature. They were studying the laws at the level of the macroscopic properties of temperature and macroscopic phenomena like temperature and heat, but they didn't know yet what the atomic microscopic physics was that explained that thermodynamics. So we can ask the same question now for black hole thermodynamics. What is the microscopic physics that explains it, that underlies it? So let's look again a little bit harder at this relationship between the entropy of a black hole and its area. I said that the entropy is equal to the area, a quarter of the area divided by four, but the area in measured in what units? Well, it turns out you can answer that question. The area is measured in Planck units, in units in which you set the speed of light, Newton's gravitational constant, and Planck's constant all to one. And in those units, the unit of length becomes of the order of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. That is 0.00 and then another 30 zeros, one of a centimeter. So very, very, very tiny. So this quantity is a number. This quantity, this entropy, is a number. And that number is, if you take the horizon of the black hole and you tile it with little squares, and each little square is one Planck length by one Planck length, so 10 to the minus 33 centimeters by 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, and you count how many little squares you have, that's the entropy. So the entropy is roughly the number of Planck-sized pixels on the horizon. Now, this black hole horizon, I've drawn it like this. I've kind of exaggerated the horizon. I've pixelated it in this way. But a black hole horizon is nothing like that. It's simply a surface in empty space-time. Now, you and I, this entire lecture theatre, in fact, the whole planet Earth, could, at this very moment, be passing across the horizon of a very large black hole, and we would not know it. There's nothing locally distinguishable about a black hole horizon that would tell us that we were passing across it. They don't give you any warning when you're falling across the horizon of a black hole, which is bad, because once you're in, you can't get out. But the horizon has nothing to mark it. There's no signpost, there's no kind of bump, there's no sudden shockwave or anything. Black hole horizon is just like any other surface in empty space-time. It just looks like empty space-time. So the value of the entropy, that it's the number of Planck-sized pixels on the horizon, suggests that there's something atomic going on, that the black hole horizon is comprised of individual microscopic somethings on the scale of the Planck length. That's what it very strongly suggests. Remember that the entropy of a box of gas is just the number of molecules in the box of gas. So it suggests that the horizon is made of a number of microscopic molecules of Planckian size. But a horizon is just a surface in empty space-time. So that suggests that space-time itself, whether or not there's a black hole there at all, space-time itself is made of microscopic grains, that space-time itself is atomic on Planckian scales. So for the remainder of my talk, I want to tell you about a particular direction of research which is aimed at passing across the threshold of unity to directly unify quantum theory with gravity. And it takes the evidence of black hole thermodynamics that space-time is fundamentally atomic or granular seriously. That's one of the tenets on which this approach is to quantum gravity is based. So it takes the granularity of space-time, and it marries it to another idea, which also has an ancient pedigree, and you can trace a thread through science that leads to it. I'm not going to do that tonight. I'm just going to pluck this new idea out of the air tonight. And that idea is that causality is space-time's most basic structure. Now, by causality, I mean cause and effect. I mean that if someone makes a loud noise over there, I drop my cup of tea. So something over there causes something over here. And we know that in space-time, not all events can causally influence all other events. So if I click my fingers like that, that's an event. There are events happening on Alpha Centauri which can never be influenced by the click of my fingers. I can't influence those events because to influence those events, something, some signal must pass from me, from this event here and now, over all the way to Alpha Centauri. And that signal must take at least the time that light takes to travel over there, at least if not more than that time. And because nothing can travel faster than light. Pace the opera neutrino experiments. So by the time the signal from this event reaches Alpha Centauri, those events are long over, and there's no way that this can influence those events on Alpha Centauri. So some events in space-time are causally unrelated. They cannot influence one another. So this information about which events in space-time can influence which other events in space-time is altogether called the causal structure of space-time. And that information is very, very rich. In fact, it's almost all the information that you need to reconstruct the curvature, the warpage, the geometry of space-time. You can trade geometrical information, curvature information, with causal information. So these two ideas, that space-time is fundamentally atomic and that causality is its basic structure, are married together into a proposal, a hypothesis, about what the microscopic substructure of space-time is. And it's something called a causal set. Hence, the approach to quantum gravity that it's based on is called causal set theory. It was independently suggested by Etoft, Mearheim, and by Bombelli, Lee, Meyer, and Sorkin. And this picture gives you just a very rough flavor of what a causal set is. Okay, so the causal set is is a bunch of individual elements. Those are the atoms of space-time. I've represented those by these black blobs. And between them, they are woven together. They are bound together. They hold their form because there are causal relations between them. So when I've illustrated the causal relation by these arrows. So something that happens here at atom A can causally influence something here at atom B. So this arrow is drawn on to represent that. But there's no causal relation between A and C, this atom over here. So nothing that happens at A can causally influence anything that happens at C or vice versa. These are causally unrelated. Okay, now this causal set here has five atoms in it. It's very, very, very unrealistic because these atoms are they exist at the Planck scale. And in a piece of space-time the size of our observable universe, there would be 10 to the 240 atoms. That's 1, 0, followed by 240 zeros. That's the number of atoms that would comprise a piece of space-time the size of our observable universe. So how does this proposal, this proposal that space-time is fundamentally a causal set, how does it deal with the question that we started with? What's the microphysics that explains black hole thermodynamics? So in particular, can we explain the black hole entropy? Well, we have a proposal, which is that the black hole entropy, what it is the number of simplest causal relations that straddle the horizon. So I've illustrated that here. This is the causal set, these space-time atoms. Let me point out that the space-time atoms are not in anything. They are itself, they are space-time. So they're not. It's impossible to draw them without drawing them on something. But the concept that of a causal set is that the atoms are space-time. The atoms and the relations constitute space-time, and there's nothing else. They're not in anything. There's no space in between them, if you like. Okay, so this is the causal set, and these atoms over here are outside the black hole horizon. So they're on this side of the red line. And these ones are inside the black hole horizon. Remember that black hole horizon is a causal horizon. Nothing inside can causally influence anything outside. And the proposal is that the black hole entropy is simply the number of causal relations which pierce the horizon, so that go from atoms which are outside the horizon to atoms which are inside the horizon. Okay. It's too early to tell you any results for this proposal. Does it do the job? Does it reproduce the black hole entropy that we know is right? So watch this space for the results. But I want to point out that this has the potential to explain the entropy not just of black hole horizons, but of all causal horizons. So it turns out black holes are only one type of causal horizons. There are other sorts of causal horizons. One sort of causal horizon arises in an expanding universe. And you can understand that by thinking about a faraway galaxy which is emitting light, the light is traveling towards us. But if the universe is expanding, then the space between us and that galaxy is getting bigger and bigger. And if it's expanding fast enough, then the space between us and the galaxy is getting bigger, is increasing fast enough that the light never gets to us. The light from that galaxy never reaches us. So events on that galaxy can never influence us here because light can never reach us from that galaxy. That galaxy is beyond a causal horizon. And the same kind of calculations that were done for black holes can be done for those cosmological causal horizons. And indeed, those cosmological causal horizons also have an entropy, and that entropy is equal to a quarter of their area. This proposal for explaining black hole entropy could be taken over exactly as is to explain potentially the entropy of cosmological causal horizons. Now, do we have any direct evidence, observational evidence, of causal sets? Well, causal sets were actually used to predict a Nobel Prize-winning observation. The Nobel Prize in question is this year's Nobel Prize, which was won by three scientists, Perlmutter, Rice, and Schmidt. And they won the prize for measuring the acceleration of the universe's expansion. And they did it by making very careful observations of very distant supernovae that are roughly 5 billion light years away. This is a picture of the remnants of a supernova, I think, that happened about 1800 years ago. The debris from the supernova is this red stuff. And it's interesting to read the interviews that they gave on the day that the Nobel Prize was announced. You can look at them on the Nobel Prize website. So they're just quick telephone interviews. And their initial reaction, all of them, all three, was, "Oh, this is a terrible mistake. It doesn't make any sense. I better go away and check because it'll just go away." But that mistake never went away. So the result was an incredible surprise to them, so much so that they thought they had just made some terrible mistake, which didn't go away, and in fact it was true. The universe's expansion is indeed accelerating. And most theorists were very shocked by this. Theorists have called the universe a preposterous place because it has this accelerated expansion. There's a small band of people who are not shocked at all, and that's those of us who are working on causal sets, because causal sets had been actually used beforehand, before the results, these observations were made, to predict exactly such an accelerated expansion. Okay, so what's the big deal about this accelerated expansion? Why were theorists so shocked? Why were the three Nobel Prize winners so convinced that they must have made a mistake? Well, an accelerated expansion of the universe can be modeled by adding an extra term to the Einstein equations that governs the behavior of our cosmos. And that term takes the form of an energy density for empty space-time. And that energy density has the symbol lambda. So often people just call this energy density lambda. And it's also known as the cosmological constant. And you'll see why in a minute I've put constant in inverted commas. Okay. So the supernovae data tells us that this cosmological constant, this lambda, is a very, very small number. The smallest number in all of physics. It's 10 to the minus 120, which is 0.00120, 119 zeros and then a one. And remember, this is an energy density of empty space-time. You can do a calculation in quantum field theory of what you would expect for the energy density of the empty space-time, and you get the answer 1. Okay, that's the wrong answer. And before the supernovae data, before anyone knew that the answer was 10 to the minus 120, getting this wrong answer, lambda equals 1, why is this answer obviously wrong? Even before the supernovae data, it's obviously wrong because the answer 1 is in Planck units. It means that there's a Planckian amount of energy in every Planck-sized piece of space. And if there were such an amount of energy in every Planck-sized piece of space, then every tiny part of space would collapse into its own little black hole, and there would be enormous curvatures on the tiniest scales, and the universe would look nothing like the large, smooth, flat universe that we see around us. So this result is obviously wrong. But that's the result the calculation gives. And so theorists, once they get this result for the calculation, say, oh, since it's not one, we know that, we just look around and we see it's not one, it must be zero. Because zero is the only other natural number you can have. Why would it be any other number apart from zero? So all theorists thought that lambda was zero, and in every single paper on cosmology, on gravity, everyone assumed that lambda was zero. Lambda has never appeared in papers, except Raphael Sorkin. In 1990, he predicted, using basic ideas from causal set theory, that lambda should be non-zero and of roughly the value that actually turned out to be measured, 10 to the minus 120. And his argument goes as follows. Lambda wants to be zero for some reason that nobody knows. So there's no understanding yet about why lambda is not the result, it's not the value that that you get when you do the quantum field theory calculation. Nobody knows why it's not one. Lambda wants to be zero. Something, some unknown physics, is driving lambda towards zero. But it can't be exactly zero. This can't happen because lambda must suffer quantum fluctuations. And there's a Heisenberg uncertainty relation between lambda and space-time volume, which is entirely analogous to the Heisenberg uncertainty relation between energy and time. Energy and time obey this uncertainty relation, and lambda is an energy density, and so its conjugate variable is then the space-time volume. So fluctuations of lambda and fluctuations in the space-time volume are not independent of each other. The smaller the fluctuations in the space-time volume, the larger the fluctuations in lambda, and the larger the fluctuations in the space-time volume, the smaller the fluctuations in lambda. Using that, and using ideas from causal set theory, Sorkin estimated what the uncertainty in the fluctuations in the space-time volume are. And it turns out that those fluctuations go like the square root of the space-time volume. Knowing that allows you to say that the fluctuations in lambda, which are all of lambda, because lambda is being driven towards zero, it's only fluctuations. Fluctuations in lambda should be of the size of 1 over the volume of space-time. And if we take the volume of space-time to be the volume of the observable universe, 10 to the 240 in Planck units, you get exactly the order the observed value 10 to the minus 120 for lambda, with a plus or minus sign here. So it's fluctuating around zero. Sometimes it's positive, sometimes it's negative. It just turned out to be positive. The observations show us that lambda is positive. But according to Sorkin's prediction, it could have been negative. It turned out to be positive. Okay. So that correct prediction of the order of magnitude of this cosmological constant, completely surprising to everybody else, so much so that the Nobel Prize winners thought they'd made a mistake, was actually a great encouragement to those of us working on causal set theory. At the beginning of my talk, I mentioned Einstein's paper on Brownian motion, published in 1905, and said that it was the final piece of evidence that convinced all physicists of the reality of atoms and molecules. Interestingly enough, there was no controversy amongst chemists. Chemists had long before accepted the existence of atoms because they were incredibly useful in describing chemical reactions. It seems that chemists were just way ahead of the physicists in accepting atoms. It seems that physicists are particularly susceptible to worries, sort of existential worries about whether the objects that seem very useful in their explanations are real or not. Other scientists don't seem to have any such worries. They're much more scientific about things. I don't think paleontologists really worry about whether dinosaurs genuinely exist or not. So what is Brownian motion, and why did it convince people that atoms and molecules exist? So Brownian motion is named for the naturalist Robert Brown, who noticed when he looked at still water under a microscope that pollen grains in that water undergo a jittery motion. The water is completely still, the water is not swirling around or moving, but the pollen grains were jittering around. Brown actually thought that the pollen was alive. He tried to explain the motion by saying that the pollen grains were some living creatures. But what Einstein and others before him believed was that the pollen grains were moving in this jittery way because they were being constantly bombarded from all sides and at random by the unseen microscopic molecules of the water. So the molecules, although they're incredibly tiny and unobservable because of their size, they reveal themselves to us by their effect on much larger things. So the Brownian particle we can see, the molecules we can't see, but we can see the effect that the molecules have on the Brownian particle. So although the atoms are very, very tiny, we can nevertheless infer their existence because we can see things on larger scales. So this is a lesson for those of us who believe in the atomicity of space-time. The atomicity is on incredibly tiny scales, on Planckian scales, and you might think it's utterly hopeless to try to look for it because the scales are way many, 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 many orders of magnitude beyond any of the physics that we can currently probe at, for example, the LHC. However, the universe is a very large place, and it might be that just as with the cosmological constant and the supernovae data, we might get evidence of the atomicity of space-time by looking at things far away from us, things that are very distant from us in the universe. And the idea would be that that matter propagating in a space-time which is fundamentally grainy, that has this fundamental atomic structure, although the effect of that atomicity would be very tiny, because things have to travel an awfully long way in the universe, those tiny effects might build up over time, and so we could observe the effect in things that reach us from the outer reaches of the universe. So matter moving through space-time, if it comes to us from very far away, it moves through a lot of space-time, the effects of the atomicity might build up, and we might be able to actually detect those effects. So this is an idea for future research. So let me return finally to Feynman's most important, most valuable scientific fact. All things are made of atoms. I've already said that space-time itself is a thing. It has its own dynamics. It bends and warps and ripples. It carries energy. So it's a thing, all right? It's material, just as much as the matter that we see around us. And if the direction of research that my colleagues and I are working on is right, then we will be able to say that all things, including space-time, are made of atoms. And I will end there. Thank you very much for listening.
Let's open the floor to questions. So, do we have a question here? Let's start right here in the front.
Hi, thank you very much. Most interesting lecture. Reminds me back to my thermodynamics days where I took at the University of Waterloo. A very basic question. When you were talking about Dr. Hawking's temperature of black holes, what came to mind is if nothing escapes the black holes except the disappearing of the photons, which you showed in your picture, how can you measure that there is really a temperature of those black holes? And the second part would be, what is that temperature?
So the temperature would be measured just as the temperature of any hot object. So we can measure the temperature of a bar heater. So it really radiates like a hot object. So the temperature will be measurable in exactly the same way that we measure the temperature of any hot object. So your other question about what is the temperature? Well, it's equal to the surface gravity in Planckian units. And you might say, well, what's the temperature of, say, a solar mass black hole? Well, I think it's pretty cold. I think the temperature of a solar mass black hole is roughly 10 to the minus 7 Kelvin. So it's not much hotter than absolute zero. And for a supermassive black hole, then it will be a billion times, 100 billion times less. I mean, the temperature would be even lower than that. So that astrophysical size black holes have a very, very, very low Hawking temperature. It's only smaller black holes which would have an appreciable temperature.
Thank you. Let's go here on my right.
Professor, how does entanglement square with causal set theory?
The honest answer is that we don't know. But I have to say, the proposal for black hole entropy that we are working on right now, it has some kind of feeling of entanglement in the sense that it pertains to this division of space-time into two pieces. And you can kind of think of the the relations that stretch across the horizon as some kind of information flow from the outside to the inside. So, the real answer is we don't know yet how entanglement could be involved in causal set theory, but there's some flavor of entanglement in the proposal for the entropy there.
And to my left.
The idea of space-time grains makes me wonder, in an expanding universe, are the number of grains increasing, or how would that work?
Well, that's a very good question. So these grains are grains of space-time and not space. So your question would be relevant if these grains made up space. But they don't make space, they make space-time. So space-time, you can think of as layers of space stacked up over time. So it's space-time is like having the whole movie laid out once and for all rather than any one frame. So the grains make up space-time, the four-dimensional space-time, three dimensions of space, one dimension of time. And the grains, if you like, you can think of the evolution of the universe as the grains coming into being and then remaining, and then other grains coming into being on to their future. So the grains make up all of space-time. So as time goes on, as the universe evolves, indeed, the number of grains is getting larger and larger. But each grain is not a point in space. Each grain is a point in space-time. It's like that. It's a here and now rather than a here.
I believe another question on my far left.
You mentioned that if you're near a very large black hole and you're passing into a very large black hole, it's impossible to tell.
Yeah.
And then you also said that something inside the event horizon of a black hole can't causally affect something outside of the black hole. So why can't we use that to tell whether we're passing into a black hole? Because I can causally affect the things around me. So why can't I use that to see whether I'm passing into a black hole or not?
Well, the things around you have fallen through as well. That's the thing is that you lose causal contact with everything that remains outside the black hole. But if something falls across the horizon with you, then you remain in causal contact with that. So if we're all together falling across the horizon of a black hole, then we just can't tell, we can't know.
And here on my right.
I gather that one of the rationales for the causal set structure that you're looking at is because of the black holes and because of the causal nature of them. But causality itself, it seems to me, is a pretty slippery concept, particularly when you look at quantum mechanics. And you guys are hopefully heading in a direction of quantum gravity, I presume. So how do you reconcile the sort of slipperiness of the quantum aspect of things with causality?
Your question is an absolutely fantastic question. We can't, at the moment, deal with what causality means. We don't know what causality means in a quantum context. That is something which we are indeed struggling over mightily at the moment. It's something which I feel if we could get to grips with it and understand causality in a quantum theory, that it would indeed absolutely help us to build a quantum theory of causal. I haven't said hardly anything about quantum theory tonight. That would be another thread that one could trace through science to arrive at causal sets. But we it's a huge question. What does causality mean, and what does relativistic causality mean in the context of a quantum theory? And we don't know, but I think it's a very important question.
Let's have one final question here on my left.
Thanks again for an excellent talk. I just wanted to ask quickly, where did the idea of causal set theory come from, and has it been applied to other areas, and can those give us some clues as to where this could lead to in terms of space-time being quantum, as you've described?
Where do ideas come from? Well, you know, one of the founding pieces of work on that leads towards the ideas that underlie causal set theory was actually done by Stephen Hawking. So he, very early on in his career, so as a very young man, he proved a result which shows that the causal structure of a space-time, all this information about which events can causally affect which other events, is almost all of the geometrical information of a space-time. So knowing the causal structure, you can reconstruct the geometry, if you like. The information in the causal structure is the information in the geometry. So the idea that fundamentally the space-time is just its causal structure is it's made plausible, it's made into something that we can work with by this result of Stevens from very early in his career. Where and how these ideas and this information percolates up through an individual researcher's mind and actually results in a proposal and a hypothesis, I can't begin to speculate on. So, but it was independently proposed by different people, and I think that's a good indication that it's something which is somehow natural, that if different people have the same idea, then it's a good sign that it could be fruitful.
Thank you, Dr.